Is this it? Mayday. Is it? Yes.
Welcome, Mayday listeners. This is Justin. Thank you for joining us. We have a very special guest with us today for an interview. First time talking to her, so we really appreciate her coming on. We have the production designer, Elizabeth Williams, from The Handmaid's Tale, joining us today. Elizabeth, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
So this is your fourth Emmy nomination. You were nominated previously for your work on the show Fargo, and you won last year for your work on The Handmaid's Tale, your first Emmy win. So tell us how it feels being nominated again this year.
Well, it's a great honor to be nominated. There are so many shows that are up for this award, and you know, the selection process is, I think, quite arduous. So being nominated is already, I find, a great honor. And then, of course, a win is always, you know, kind of what you hope for. I think everyone hopes to win. So it's great. And it's great for me, of course, but it's also great for the team, for the art department, everyone else who's involved, because, you know, a win for the art department is also a win for everyone, really. Truly, because, you know, if we win, it means that the lighting was great. It means that the acting was great. It means that, you know, the story was great. It means all of that, right? So because without great acting, the sets, you know, aren't as interesting to look at. I mean, that's the truth. So yeah, you know, it's an honor for me and for the show, I find. And this year, I mean, this year is really great because I guess there were some rules that changed in the Academy, I guess, last year, and we were able to submit the last three episodes of season two. And so we chose the episode called Holly, and you know, and I thought that, you know, since we had won for season two last year, I kind of thought that, you know, the voters would pass us by, but, you know, we were nominated, so I'm really thrilled. I mean, it was a surprise to me, and so I'm happy. I'm very happy.
So The Handmaid's Tale, everyone we've talked to, has been a kind of a different experience for people coming from previous productions. What's it been like working on The Handmaid's Tale as opposed to working on the shows that you previously worked on?
Well, I feel like I've been lucky, or they're all this way. But I've heard, you know, not horror stories, but I've heard that, you know, shows that don't go very well. I've been particularly lucky, I guess, on, you know, Fargo and on, you know, Channel Zero that I've worked on with NBC, and now on The Handmaid's Tale. You know, some, you know, considerable shows that are big and that require a lot of management and a lot of people sitting around the table. It runs well. I mean, people are very collaborative, very respectful of everyone else's position and everyone else's input. And it really is a good experience, you know, and a creative and collaborative experience.
So you are from Canada, correct?
Mm-hmm. I'm from Montreal. Yeah.
And what was your exposure to The Handmaid's Tale prior to working on the show? And how did you become involved in the show? If you can talk about that.
Well, my exposure was simply that I'd read the book when I was in my late teens. And then that was it. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it. And I was working on Fargo in Calgary. And Warren Littlefield is the executive producer on The Handmaid's Tale, was also the executive producer on Fargo. And so I did the second season of Fargo as art director, and then the third season of Fargo as production designer. And Warren invited me to come to The Handmaid's Tale. Truth be told, he actually invited me to the work on the second season from the get-go, and I wasn't able to do that. I had to come home. I have two children at home that I leave behind when I work on these projects. So I really did have to come home and take care of my family, and it was needed, and I think well deserved. And so I declined, and the production hired Mark White, who did an excellent job in prep. And then Mark had to leave the show during the first week of shooting, I think. And so Warren gave me a call and he said, "Have you spent enough time with your family yet? And would you be willing, if I asked you to come, how quickly could you get here?" And so he called me on a Sunday. I think it was a Sunday night, and I was at work on Wednesday. Yeah, that's how I got to The Handmaid's Tale.
Had you seen the show at that point before you got the call from Warren?
Yes, because when he originally invited me to do the show, it was in May of the previous year. And so the show was actually on the air. So I watched a couple of episodes on the air, and then I watched them before I arrived to The Handmaid's Tale. I watched them in, the first few days. I binged them basically so that I could come to work and be, sort of be knowing what I was doing, sort of.
Now, my next question was going to be about what you thought Warren saw in your work that he thought would work for The Handmaid's Tale. But during my research, I was looking at your bio from your website, and it contained this line, which I think explains everything. "Elizabeth has thrived on translating emotions, fears, obsessions, anguish, and manias into something visible and tangible." Sounds like a no-brainer to me.
Honestly, Warren, in his position, is very, quiet and observant. And originally, I had no idea what he saw in me. You know what I mean? When you're younger, and I was kind of at the beginning of the important, more visible part of my career. And I it was such an honor for him to offer this to me. I think I do bring, honestly, I think I do bring a certain sensitivity to the sets, I guess. I'm fascinated with psychology and people's socioeconomic backgrounds and how that's translated into how they live, and so that you could apply that to any circumstance, and you're able to basically build or create a set that is multi-layered, and so that's what interests me. And I think Warren, another thing that Warren said, though, is that there's the creative part, but he said, Elizabeth, he said, there are a lot of production designers out there who are very, very creative. And then there are a lot of other production designers who are maybe less creative, but very, very good at, managing a team. And he said, you're the perfect mix of both. Your left brain is just as strong as your right brain, and that's what we need. It was wonderful. I was like, oh my goodness.
So before we get too far into The Handmaid's Tale specific stuff, I just wanted to talk about kind of the role of the production designer and what that is and what you're responsible for that we see when we're watching the show.
Okay. Well, a production designer, basically takes the script and makes it visible, which means that depending on the action and depending on the description that's scripted of a certain space, the production designer's role is to basically create an environment that best reflects, the story and the character and the action that's going to take place. And so basically it's like creating a nest in which the story unfolds. Let's take Dr. Lawrence's house, for example, I think it reflects his multi-layered personality and is kind of, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There's a lot of confusion in exactly who Commander Lawrence is, and by making his environment so like dense with information, I think you're able to give the viewer, in addition to the action that's going on, a sense of kind of doom, maybe, or confusion as to what exactly he represents. And so that's my job. My job is to, you know, with the colors and the materials and the style, the architecture, the aesthetics of everything, my job is to make that tangible.
So you're responsible for a lot of what we see, the props, the art, and the set. It really covers a lot of ground.
Yeah, exactly. All of those things, the artwork, all the props, all the set decoration. So, you know, all the set dressing, the plants. And then when we go outside, the picture cars, all that falls under the production design.
And so how do you work and collaborate with the other departments when you're working to create the production design elements of the show? Do you work a lot together?
You know, there's obviously the directors and the DPs are involved in you know, creating the look of the show. You know, with the lighting, we have a dialogue about what's best. For example, the types of windows or window dressing that we need, that they need. You know, we basically have this dialogue to make with the directors as well. You know, what layout best fits the action. You know, if I'll give you an example, in the kitchen of Commander Lawrence, at one point, you know, there's a fireplace on the right of the kitchen. In the original design, we had created this kitchen that had the fireplace in the middle of the room, and it was gorgeous, and everyone agreed. The director agreed, the DP thought it was wonderful. And then as we got closer to shooting, the director started working on his shots and how he was going to make the actors come in and out. And he realized that the fireplace was actually in the way. And it was in the eye lines. And, you know, we stood in the room and we looked, you know, we from every corner, and it was kind of always in the way. So we moved it over to one side. So in that sense, there's a dialogue, you know. So the idea of the fireplace is mine. But then if it doesn't work, I work with them to move it. Or if I have to, I get rid of it or whatever.
Now, having started in season two of the show with some of the elements already in place, what kind of research did you do on your own, and what did you take inspiration-wise from in order to create the things we see on The Handmaid's Tale that we see in Gilead?
Well, we do a lot of research, and I have a team, you know, that helps as well. We pull out as many images as we can for whichever set that we're thinking about. So for Gilead, when I first arrived, the first sets or the first world that I was responsible for was the colonies in season two and the barn in which the women live. And so that was my main focus when I first arrived. And for that, we did a lot of research on, you know, gulags and on World War II and concentration camps and labor farms. And so we pull all these images together and put them up on a board. And we basically take inspiration. And kind of like Margaret Atwood has said for her book, there's nothing in my book that doesn't come from reality that hasn't already happened. So we do the same. I mean, we're inspired by reality, and basically we create our world based on a world that already exists. We take bits and pieces of different environments, and we create our own world.
Now, you mentioned the colonies, and that was a very different look from the rest of Gilead. So what were some of those design elements that you used to create the look for the colonies?
Well, if we talk about the field, the colony, the work, the exterior work fields, you know, for example, we painted trees. with biodegradable paint. So we didn't ruin the trees, but we actually painted the trees brown so that they would look like they were burnt. We also torched some saplings and had them, you know, placed in the field so that it would look like, you know, they had been contaminated. We worked with special effects to create rivulets and had, you know, smoke coming out of the ground. What else did we do? My goodness, we found this location. It was this old quarry that had been abandoned, and so it was all overgrown with, you know, with weeds and trees and whatnot. So we had a section of it mowed. Basically, we had all the trees taken out and all of the, you know, all of the weeds and the saplings taken out, and then we worked the soil to make it look like a labor farm. It was a huge endeavor, and when we started the process, there was snow. We had to build a road to get us down to the pit. It was a huge endeavor, yeah. And then when they're in the barn, that was a working barn, and so the farmer who was there, I mean, there were pigs in the basement of the barn. You know, the barn was full of hay, and so we had the barn emptied, we had it, you know, cleaned and made it worker friendly. And we basically rebuilt the barn on the inside to make sure that there wouldn't be any, you know, any accidents and whatnot. Yeah, and created this basically concentration camp-like settings for the women.
Now, what are some of the design elements that maybe you can think of that are maybe hidden away or that audiences may not have noticed on their first viewing that are maybe kind of things that you can think of that maybe we didn't see?
I think that, you know, especially in the world of Gilead, other than Commander Lawrence's house, which we've just talked about, most of the sets are very pure, and there isn't much that isn't essential and isn't really supposed to be there and that the audience doesn't see. There aren't really that many hidden treasures. The only thing that could be a bit of an Easter egg would be that in Commander Lawrence's kitchen, there is a painting by Vermeer, which was the inspiration color-wise for the colony's field. And that is just a bit of a clin d'œil, you know, to season two, because we built Lawrence's kitchen in season three, and in season two we used the Vermeers, and you know, the costume designer used Vermeer, art department did, Colin Watkinson did. We each had our own little painting that we were basing our creation on. And mine was that one. And so I put it in the kitchen.
So a couple of things that were pointed out from season three, a couple Easter egg type things that people pointed out were the statue that at Jezebel's that June uses ultimately to deliver that final blow that kills Commander Winslow. That appears to be a statue of a woman. And also there is a wooden screen that is kind of between the bedroom and the living area that appears to have a swastika design in it. Can you tell us about those and whether those are accurate depictions or not? And if those were intentional choices you all made for the show?
Those are accurate descriptions. The statue is a art department creation. We actually worked on 10 different prototypes of statuettes, and that was the one that was chosen, and in the end by the director, our sculptor had made 10. I chose 3, and the director preferred that one, so that is the one that we ended up using. It is the statue of a woman. It is to represent fertility, but in that very brutalist dictatorial world. So it's a combination of fertility and, you know, harsh dictatorship. So the screen, in all honesty, was a a happy mistake in the sense that we had designed in season two, we had designed a screen for Jezebels. And when we did the first design, it was just something geometric. And then when we put all of the, basically when we repeated the image, we noticed that it basically created a swastika. And then we thought, okay, are we going to keep it or are we going to change it? And it was a conscious creative decision to keep it because it was subtle enough that, you know, only certain viewers were going to recognize it. And you know, we didn't want to make it a thing, but we didn't want to get rid of it either. And so this year when we built the room, we built that room in the studio. And so, you know, we built the screen that was around the bed and all the doors and we kept the same design intentionally. And so it's one of those things that I always love to see when I read, you know, commentary from people on the internet who are real fans of the show, who will, you know, catch things. I think it's fantastic.
So there are times where you get to go beyond the walls of Gilead to places like Canada and the colonies. Talk about the different approaches you have to take when you're going to different locations like that and the inspiration that you put in for those places.
It is a challenge to keep our world separate, right? We have Gilead, we have Canada, we have Boston, and this year we had Washington. And so, Canada is... I find that contemporary sets are always a bit of a challenge because to make them, you know, aesthetically pleasing yet make them realistic, there's a fine line. You know, so if we take, you know, sets like Little America, which we wanted very messy and Luke's apartment is, you know, full of objects and, you know, plants and it's just kind of chaotic. But yet it has to remain, you know, something that people want to watch. It has to remain aesthetic, right? There's always that delicate balance that we have to keep. We also, it's important for us to keep a contrast between Gilead and Canada so that when the story switches from one to the other, that the difference is obvious on the screen. I mean, other than that, what's important to us is that since we shoot in and around Toronto, we're very careful with the choices of our locations. And now I've worked on 26 episodes. So after 26 episodes, or when you're at the 26th, we kind of feel like we're kind of running out of choices, or that we've made a mistake because we've chosen a location that was, you know, that would have better served as Gilead than Canada, for example. So it's always a bit of a struggle, I have to say, to keep all those things separate and make the right choices at the right time. Obviously the locations that we look for and that we choose represent the hierarchy between the commanders and the power that they have. There's that, and so, you know, and then we also partially work with the locations that we find. You know, there is a compromise sometimes that is made to reach our goal. So if you take, for example, you know, Commander Lawrence and Commander Waterford, or Commander Lawrence and Commander Winslow. So those choices are about power and they are about personality. You know, Lawrence was a professor. He's lived in this house with his wife even before Gilead. So it is, you know, it's filled with not only the art that he's stolen or taken from museums, but also things that he's collected over the years. There's a certain warmth, a professorial-like feel to the house. Commander Winslow, on the other hand, you know, he's at the top of the food chain and he's got this gigantic, opulent home that is filled with, you know, again, art and pool table, and, you know, it breathes wealth. And so those are the kinds of things that we look for when we look for our locations. Although Commander Lawrence, I have to say, was built in the studio, but it was based on an original house.
Now, another awesome thing that everybody loved this season was we finally got to go outside of the Boston area of Gilead and get into Washington, D.C., which was amazing and got, I'm sure, offered you a lot of freedom to do some different things. It really had this overpowering sense of dread and, you know, how much worse things could be outside of what we've seen in Gilead already. So talk about that and what went into creating that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that here's a perfect example of how all the departments bring their art to the table to create an ambiance that, you know, tells a story. The creation of Washington is basically derived from the script. The Lincoln Memorial is scripted. There was no other way for us to do it. It is a story point. The way that the art department and the rest of production added to that element is by choosing locations like the train station and stripping them of everything that wasn't essential, and replacing with Gilead flags, with, you know, guards and military vehicles, and this regimented way the actors moved, you know, in rows and columns, and all of those things put together gave that sense of dread that Washington had.
Has there ever been any specific requests from actors when it comes to the production design? Because you always hear about the actors having these deep backstories for their characters plotted out. So have you had any of them come to you with special requests, anything specific that they thought would lend to the production of their character?
Actually, that happened once. Other than that, the actors are very receptive of what we build for them. It's never happened that they've been, you know, unhappy or confused or have said, this is not who I am, I don't understand the set. On the contrary, they've always said, oh my goodness, this helps me be, you know, my character, this, you know, so that's been really great. I did have one really great exchange with Bradley Whitford about his character when we built his office, because when we started the show we didn't have all the scripts, and so as the episodes went on, we added to the house, and the office came a little bit later. I think it was in episode 4, I think, and we were discovering Commander Lawrence at the same time as Bradley was. And there was, you know, we kept having to adjust to who we thought he was. And so in creating his office, I had a talk with him about, you know, who he thought he was and what is it that he would have been doing in this office, because the script doesn't tell us this. You know, it'll give us one scene, but it doesn't really tell us what the background is or so it was interesting, because at that particular moment he was not struggling, but he was thinking about his character, and I was thinking about what his office should look like, and together we just talked about it, and it was great. It was really great.
So we got to talk to your editor, Wendy Hallam Martin. She's also nominated for Creative Arts Emmy this weekend. And we were talking a little bit about the return to more practical effects and using CGI only in places where it's deemed necessary or not as cost effective as doing things practically. So talk to us about that, and if you're seeing that in production design elements as well, because that's so much what we're seeing on the screen these days.
Yeah, I've noticed that as well in the last few years. You know, a few years back, maybe, I don't know, 10 maybe, there was this big, you know, push to do things CGI. It was, you know, it was new, it was extraordinary, and I guess we thought that we could do things with CGI that we couldn't do without. But there's definitely a trend to go back to mechanical effects rather than visual effects. And, you know, that's the same with snow or water or smoke. Yes, definitely smoke, because it doesn't look right. And the thing is people are now demanding, and rightly so, you know, now that most of our entertainment is on television, I think the audience is very critical of what they watch. And, you know, fake smoke looks like fake smoke, and it takes you out of the action and, you know, makes you focus on the smoke rather than what's going on. And we don't want that. I mean, CGI still is important. You know, they sometimes actually not all there. It's essential, especially, for example, on a show like The Handmaid's Tale. Let's say we're dressing a street for a Gilead scene. I mean, the art department will take care of all of the signage that is to about 10 feet, maybe 12 in the air. But anything that is above that, be it street signs or posters in windows or things that we don't want to see, CGI comes in behind and erases it for us, because we can't, it would be impossible, and sometimes it's, we're not even allowed to physically remove it, so they have to remove it in post. Same thing with snow. You know, sometimes our special effects will blanket a location with snow, but then the crew is walking on it, and it's CGI will come in post and just clean it up for us, you know, and make it look perfect. So it's collaboration.
All right. Well, do you have any upcoming projects that you'd like to talk about? Anything on the horizon for you beyond Handmaid's Tale?
Well, I actually am going to do season 4 of The Handmaid's Tale. So that's what's coming up for me. I chose to stay home and take care of my children this summer. So I will go from season 3 directly into season 4. And then we'll see. Maybe it'll be The Testaments, Margaret Atwood's new book, or I don't know. Can't wait to read it.
Well, we definitely look forward to any news forthcoming about that, obviously. And we thank you for joining us on the podcast today. We really, really appreciate it. Have a good one, and best of luck at the Emmys.
Thank you so much.